This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Comic Sarah Silverman finds hilarious and often subversive ways of addressing sexism and ethnic stereotypes and the things that make us self-conscious about our own bodies. She starred in her own TV series, created comic videos that have gone viral, hosted the Independent Spirit Awards, and has a recurring role in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. She won an Emmy for her 2013 HBO comedy special, We Are Miracles. But her new movie, I Smile Back, isn't a comedy. She stars as a wife and mother living in the suburbs who's overcome by anxiety and is profoundly depressed. Silverman has had serious bouts of depression herself, dating back to age 13. She spoke with Terry last Thursday. They began with a clip from the film. In this scene, Silverman's character has started rehab. After going off her meds, she'd begun self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. She's talking to her therapist, played by Terry Kinney.
So where would you like to start?
What's more interesting for you, the daddy issues or the drugs?
Well, I like to start with the daddy issues because it's a very organic segue into the drugs.
Mine's boring. My dad left when I was 9. That's the whole story. He kissed me goodnight, and that's the last time I saw him. So, drugs?
Yeah, we'll get to that. Can you tell me why you haven't spoken again?
He didn't call me.
Why didn't you call him?
Because I didn't know where he lived.
Oh.
Sarah Silverman in a scene from I Smile Back. Sarah Silverman, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a great performance that you give in this. Your face turns into a mask in the movie, a mask that's somewhere between hostile and just opaque blankness. I know you've had depression in the past. Do you feel like that's how you must have looked during periods of depression?
Yeah. Yeah, I do think that Lainey is somebody who feels several emotions, and they're right on the surface of her skin, and then she kind of expertly covers that. And it's not that she's dead inside, it's that she feels too much and needs to self-medicate. And, you know, I understand, you know, even as a teen bedwetter, or a bedwetter at sleepover camp, I understand the total disassociation it takes to get through just an average day. You know, like, this is a weird association to the plight of Lainey, but waking up soaking wet in a room with 7 girls you don't know and then just making the bed like everyone else over it and pretending like this isn't happening and being in such a disassociative state, I understand that, you know. I don't know if that sounds crazy.
No. For people who aren't aware of this, your memoir was called Bedwetter, and it was about your experiences, in part about your experiences having that problem when you were young.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's also, you know, like scenes where in the movie where you're looking in the mirror when you're depressed and you're examining yourself very judgmentally, your face, your breasts, you're kind of pulling up your breasts as if to see, well, how would they look if they were lifted? Is this,
right.
And is this...
They used to be here. Yeah.
Is this an exercise you're familiar with as well, as I think a lot of people are?
Yeah. Yes. It's funny because there are weird mirrorings of my stand-up and this movie, and it's, you know, of course, kind of polar. They're yin and yang of each other, and I guess that means that they do kind of go together in an odd way. But, you know, where I say, nice try, mirror. You know, those are obviously those are obviously my mother's boobs. And I don't think there's a woman in her 40s who, you know, who doesn't examine herself in the mirror. And when I catch myself doing that, I make myself say, I'm strong and my body works. You know, and it helps, you know. But one of the greatest things my therapist said to me, look in the mirror less. And I just thought, oh, right. That's great. Of course, you know.
Did you take your therapist's advice and look in the mirror less?
I do. I look in the mirror less. For an actress who needs right. who needs the approval of strangers.
Well, you also need to know what you look like. Like, you're playing a part on stage, even if it's the part of yourself, you know.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do look in the mirror when I'm doing something. But
And then you have to watch videos of yourself, too, and movies. So you're kind of forced to see yourself.
I'm pretty good at it. I always look at myself knowing that I will have a certain degree of cognitive distortion, you know, so I put it on a bell curve. I kind of adjust what I'm seeing and know that it's better than what I'm seeing, for whether that's true or not.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sarah Silverman, who's best known for her comedy, but she stars in the new drama I Smile Back as a woman who is a mother and wife and very, very depressed. Would you describe a little bit your experience of what depression is and how that's different from being sad? Because I think a lot of people don't understand that difference.
Yeah, I can only speak from my own experience. And I would say that the depression I experienced feels like a chemical change. When it came over me and when it comes over me, it feels like it's coming over me like a flu. Like, you ever just sit, you're just sitting there and you're fine, and then you just, the next moment you just go, oh, Jesus, I have the flu. You know, like, it just, mm-hmm. it's that fast. It felt like that. And it was especially when it happened in my early teen years. I was about 13. It was like my perspective of the world changed about 3 degrees, and everything I saw was different. And I had been an extremely social person with best friends and the class clown, and all of that meant nothing suddenly. I didn't see any reason. Being with friends felt like a burden. I remember just sobbing, and I was sitting on my stepfather's lap, and he was the first one, really the only one of my parents who asked me what it felt like. You know, I hadn't been put in a position to say, like you asked me just now, you know, what does it feel like? And I remember what I said, because it really still stands. It's exactly, I would say that it's the perfect description. It felt like I was desperately homesick, which was something I was familiar with from going to camp in the summer. I said, it feels like I'm terribly homesick, but I'm home. There's no way to satiate it, you know. And I don't know that I knew the word satiate at that time, but I don't know what I said specifically, but that was what I said, and that's what it felt like.
When you were 13 and overcome by depression, did you have any context for understanding it?
No. You know, my mother suffered from depression, but I didn't understand that at the time. I just thought she slept all the time, you know. Of course, now I understand that she too suffered from a great deal from depression. But I didn't. I didn't know anyone like this. I had a teacher. She wasn't even my teacher. She was just a teacher who took a liking to me, and I liked her. Her name was Mrs. Pope. And to give you an idea of how Goyam, the town I lived in New Hampshire, and Mrs. Pope, and she was so warm and lovely, and she said, you know, this happens to some people, and what you can hold on to is that when you come out the other side, you're richer for it, you know. And it was something I kind of was able to cling to.
Were you medicated when you were 13?
I was medicated. I was sent to a psychiatrist this is a crazy story. I was sent to a psychiatrist who said, I'm going to give you a prescription for something called Xanax, and whenever you feel bad, you take one. And my mother dropped me off for my second appointment with him, and I remember being in the waiting room and reading an entire People magazine, and I thought, I've never read a whole People magazine. That must have been so much time that's passed, you know, and I didn't know where he was, and he shared an office with a hypnotist who I also went to for bedwetting, which was didn't help at all. And he came down with no bedside manner for a 13-year-old girl and just he was sobbing, and he just screamed at me that my doctor had hung himself.
Oh, gee.
I know. It's really over the top. And I had, you know, this is before cell phones or anything, way before, and I just had to wait for the hour to be over for my mom to pick me up.
Well, what kind of lesson did you take away from that? The doctor is supposed to be helping you is in such despair he kills himself. I mean, that's so reinforcing that, like, no, this isn't going to end. Life is terrible. The smart people who know better know how bad it is.
Yeah. It was weird because I don't remember it. And a cognitive distortion. I don't know. I have no idea the truth of what I went through or processed. I don't remember crying or I just remember, all I remember thinking was because he had braces on his teeth. And that was something I noticed when I saw him, the one appointment I saw him. And then when that happened, I thought, gee, he didn't even wait to get his braces off, you know, because for a 13-year-old, that's, you know, when life starts is when you get your braces off. And I remember that perplexing me.
So what happened after that? Did you go to another doctor?
I did. I went, my parents who just wanted to help me, you know, I mean, they found this woman who is a registered nurse in Boston. And so we would drive an hour to Boston before school and I would talk to her and she would just prescribe more Xanax. And her husband was a doctor and he would write the prescription. I mean, really, this woman should be in jail. Ultimately, she had me by the time I was 14, I was taking 4 Xanax 4 times a day.
That's
16
a
Xanax
lot.
A day.
That is really, especially for a 13-year-old, that's crazy.
A prepubescent, very small for my age.
How did you function?
I don't remember I just felt kind of numb.
How did you stay awake?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know anyone who can take, I don't know what the milligrams of each pill were, but it's certainly absurd. And I remember my parents, especially at that time, you just trusted what doctors said you completely. And I would keep the empty bottles of Xanax in a shoebox. And I just thought, well, somebody finds me and I'm dead or something. They'll know what was happening, you know. But I eventually went to another psychiatrist in New Hampshire named Dr. Santiago, who was shocked and mortified at how much Xanax I was taking every day and very, very carefully got me off of it, a half a pill less a week. And it took about, 6 months or something until I was completely off of it. And by that time, I was back. I was 16 and I felt like myself again.
So when the depression came back when you were in your 20s, was it a different experience than when you were in your teens?
It was a different experience because it came over me as fast as the flu again, like a cloud covering the sun that fast. And I recognized it. You know, the first time it happened, I had nothing to compare it to. And it was almost worse. I don't know if it was worse, but I recognized it right away. And, you know, knowing that the first time it lasted 3 years and it was immediate terror, you know. And I had paralyzing panic attacks and I had been hired at Saturday Night Live already and was working there. And I remember thinking, I want to move home to New Hampshire. That's the first thing you think, you know, is like you just want to go home and you don't want to do anything scary. And then I found a woman who put me on a pill called Klonopin that all it does is block panic attacks. And that really saved my life in that I was able to go to work at Saturday Night Live and exist through each day while I was figuring this out.
When was the last time you had a depression?
I have intermittent downward spirals, but nothing like I had in my early 20s when it was that kind of cloud covering the sun again. I've since been put on, since 94, I've been on a low dose of Zoloft that, you know, has been a godsend to me, and I feel like I can live life. So I'm very lucky. I understand that antidepressants are probably really prescribed willy-nilly these days. And, you know, I mean, teenagers go through extreme depression as a part of their human growth as well, you know. So I think that it should be something very carefully prescribed, you know. But for me, it was a perfect fit. And it seems to, I don't want to out my family, but, you know, for a lot of my immediate family seemed to be the exact kind of missing link for them too, is that same kind of family of meds. And so I've been lucky. I have lows, and, you know, everybody does. And I don't have people to compare it to. I'm a comedian, and, you know, we kind of share the highs and lows to a degree, you know. But I kind of know how to handle it. I like to let myself wallow in it. I enforce it with terribly sad music, and it kind of pushes me through to the other side eventually. And I always know it's going to pass.
I want to ask you about your mother. I'm so sorry she died in August. She was 73. I read an obit about her, and it said that she had founded a theater company in New Hampshire, which I hadn't realized. How old was she, and how old were you when she founded it?
Maybe I was 10, which would make her 40.
Mm-hmm. So did that mean a lot in your life in terms of becoming a performer eventually?
Probably, you know. Yeah, I always wanted to do that. She was always, well before that, passionate about plays and theater and every part of it, the costumes and the sets. And so she went back to college when she got divorced, and that's where she met her husband, John, who was her logic and philosophy professor, and gave her her only B, I think, you know. And they didn't have a theater department, and she started one there, and the New Thalian Players. And, boy, she got everyone in the community involved, and they did 50 plays. And at her funeral, it was so moving. There were so many of her actors, you know, came and gave teary eulogies. And one guy I never, you know, I didn't know, came up, and he said, you know, I was working at Applebee's. You know, this is Manchester, New Hampshire, you know. He said, I was working at Applebee's. And Beth Ann, I was sitting at the table I was waiting on, and she said, you're tall and handsome. Do you act or sing? And I said, I don't know. And she said, why don't you come on down to the audition and see? And he said, that year I played Curly in Oklahoma. and he had been a part of the theater company ever since. And she really kind of collected these people that didn't know what they had inside them. And she gave so many people such self-esteem and opened their eyes up to such a totally new world. People from all sorts of jobs and lives that were never exposed to theater before, that this became their home and their community. And, you know, I remember being 12 and everybody calling her mom and being so mad because she was my mom. You know, now I have, you know, 20-year-old comedians in my life that call me Ma. And I love it because of that, you know.
Oh, how lucky you were to be able to hear them at the memorial talk about her that way.
It was amazing. It was just really, it was such a great funeral. I don't think I've ever cried so hard in my life, where the next day it looked like I had two black eyes and such a headache just from, like, I think I had like bursting blood vessels. But also laughs, and, you know, the funeral home people said, we've never heard so many laughs in a funeral, you know. But it's interesting, you know, grief is something that is, it takes so many shapes. And, you know, my oldest sister, Susan, who's a rabbi and, you know, really took the reins of arranging the funeral and everything, along with my aunt Martha, my mother's sister and best friend. And I think she was so in charge, and she surprised herself that she didn't cry at all. And she didn't cry for a while. And she got an email out of nowhere from a friend, and it just said, you don't think you're grieving, but you are. And that was the first time she cried. But I just, when she told me that story, I was so moved. And it is so true that grief takes so many shapes, and you just, it's not something that you fail or succeed at. You know, it takes care of itself, you know.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing some memories of your mother. One last question, and this gets back to how we started the discussion, which is about depression. And you were talking about how depression is really different from sadness, and it's really different from grief. But when you were grieving for your mother, particularly in that period immediately following her death, and, you know, you talked about just being surprised at how much you sobbed during the funeral, did that threaten to bring on depression, or is depression, like, so different than grieving that you could grieve without worrying that you would be sent over to the other side?
No, it's so different. In fact, you know, crying at the funeral was so cathartic and was such a group situation, you know, where, you know, the actual funeral and the days of being home in New Hampshire were cathartic and were kind of wonderful, you know. Everyone came home, all my step-siblings and my siblings and my dad and my stepmother were, you know, with her when she passed. And so we were with just this group of people all home to celebrate, you know, this woman's life and to cry and laugh. And so it was like this amazing experience. And then what I realized is the real hard part is going home to regular life, to everyday life, where you're not surrounded by people who are going through the same thing. And, you know, there was a while at first where it was like everybody I saw, I was afraid I was going to say, my mom died, you know, like yeah. it was harder. That was harder in a way. And it comes and goes in waves, you know, because I keep wanting to call her, or having that knee-jerk reaction to calling her. I sent like a group family email a couple weeks ago, and Susie said, do you know that you mom was in that, you emailed mom? And I didn't even feel it, you know. But especially now that I'm doing press for this, and I just did Inside the Actor's Studio, and it between that and doing Fresh Air with Terry Gross and talking about her and her life and her career, I mean, she would have just she would have just been blown away. Totally blown away, you know, and she's like kind of this one person in my life that is so into this stuff, and so it makes me miss her, but yeah.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss. She sounded like a wonderful person. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. And for
thank
sharing,
you. What a depressing what conversation. This is entertaining in some way to people.
Well,
but you're always wonderful to talk to.
And you're wonderful to talk to. And I think what you said is very nourishing, because it's so true. So thank you very much.
Thank you, as do I. You.
Sarah Silverman stars in the new dramatic film I Smile Back. She spoke with Terry last Thursday. Steven Spielberg's latest film, Bridge of Spies, opened last weekend to nearly universal acclaim. Set during the Cold War, the movie stars Tom Hanks as an American attorney who finds himself suddenly plunged into the world of espionage. Our critic at large, John Powers, admires the film and its treatment of the Cold War.
If you're old enough to remember the Cold War, you probably miss it. Things were just so neat back then. Granted, we lived under the threat of being vaporized by nukes, but at least the enemy seemed rational and disciplined. You could make deals with the Soviets, unlike today's beheaders and suicide bombers. Of course, that whole period is still with us in many ways, starting with Vladimir Putin's recent machinations. He clearly misses the Cold War, too. There are TV series like The Americans about Ruski spies in Reagan-era D.C., and an endless stream of bios, like David Talbot's revealing new book on Alan Dulles, that cobra in a suit who ran the CIA from 1952 through the Bay of Pigs. As it happens, Dulles turns up briefly, and too warm-bloodedly, in Bridge of Spies, Steven Spielberg's highly entertaining new thriller, which excavates a tiny corner of that history without overinflating its importance. With the Red Scare safely behind us, this real-life story takes us inside the prosaic details of that era's bargaining and posturing, while also viewing it with historical perspective. It's about the Cold War, rather than caught within its passions. Beginning in a 1957 New York throbbing with anti-communist paranoia, it stars Tom Hanks as high-powered attorney James B. Donovan. The U.S. government asks Donovan to defend the captured Soviet spy Rudolf Abel, who's played by Mark Rylance with an irony as dry as a martini in Death Valley at noon. The intent is to show the world that Americans will give Abel a fair defense, before, of course, executing him. But Donovan defends Abel so well that he avoids the death penalty. And so a few years later, the CIA asks him to arrange the swap of the imprisoned Abel for the captured American spy pilot Francis Gary Powers, who was shot down over the USSR. Donovan flies off to Berlin just as the wall is being built, a milieu and mood that Spielberg does a superb job of recreating. Donovan's there to do what he does best, be a bulldog of a negotiator. Here, he's in East Berlin haggling with a slippery Soviet attaché, who's refusing to trade Powers for Abel.
This is not an equitable trade, sir.
But what you're saying is, if Powers has given up everything he knows, then Moscow would trade? Why wouldn't they? As for Abel, if he dies in an American prison, the next Russian operative who gets caught might think twice about keeping his mouth shut. And you never know. Abel might want to see the sky again and decide to trade Russian secrets for small American favors.
How can we know this? We little men, we just do our jobs.
Like Lieutenant Powers. He's just a pilot.
He was making photographs from 70,000 feet when he was shot from the sky. People in my country consider this an act of war.
Now, Bridge of Spies is in many ways an old-fashioned Hollywood picture, which I mean as a compliment. Donovan is the kind of everyman hero, moral but a tad prickly, wry but no pushover, once played by Henry Fonda and James Stewart. In both image and manner, Hanks is their heir, and having already saved Private Ryan, he now makes this Irish-American lawyer sturdier than the Berlin Wall. Like the film itself, Hanks's Donovan is solid and measured. Yet for all its retro pleasures, the movie feels fresh in its take on the Cold War. For starters, this is surely the friendliest portrait of a Soviet spy in Hollywood history. Although Rudolf Abel was a devout communist, Bridge of Spies portrays him as being as honorable as Donovan. The two enjoy a mutual respect and share an equal disdain for the cynics who populate both sides, be it shifty commissars or CIA spooks who care only about the mission, not the human fallout. The movie brings the Cold War alive in another way, too. It's relevant to our own days, when terrorism can produce the same knee-jerk stridency that communism once did. In their fear and hatred of the Reds, most Americans, including government officials, didn't care whether Abel got fair treatment before the law. Donovan did. That's the point of laws. And he fueled the public's hatred by not just defending Abel, but doing it scrupulously. He believed that America didn't prove its strength by killing off spies without fair trials. It did so by honoring the principles embedded in the U.S. Constitution, even when, and especially when, it's tempting not to. In Bridge of Spies, America's greatest asset in the Cold War wasn't possessing superior information or military might. It was having faith in our values.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. That's the song of the sharp-tailed grouse. We're going to hear some other remarkable bird calls and talk about some of the other remarkable abilities birds possess. We have two guests. Garrett Vinn goes to extremes to photograph birds and record their songs. He says birds are visible and powerful indicators of environmental health and change. He shot the photographs for the new book, The Living Bird, a production of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Vin is a producer for the lab and has contributed to National Geographic and Audubon. Scott Wiedensahl contributed essays to The Living Bird and is now in the process of banding baby owls, that is, attaching a lightweight bracelet around the leg of an owl so the bird's migratory journey can be tracked. He co-directs Project OwlNet, a collaborative effort among research stations across North America studying owl migration. He's also the author of the new book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Owls of North America and the Caribbean. They spoke with Terry last Tuesday and began with the sounds of two caterwauling barred owls, recorded by Garrett Vinn.
Oh, that is so fabulous. Garrett Vinn, Scott Wiedensahl, welcome to Fresh Air. Garrett, you recorded the sound that we just heard. So tell us more about what we just heard.
Yep, that was recorded down in a dark, moonless night in a bayou in Arkansas, and it's a pair of barred owls. Barred owls are a widespread owl species in North America. And what you hear there is a pair of owls that are pretty worked up because there's another pair of owls nearby, and they're exclaiming their territory with these caterwauling calls. And you can hear a faint call of a young owl in the background.
I thought owls are supposed to hoot. That sounds like nothing like a hoot.
Well, there are a tremendous diversity of calls that owls make, actually, all sorts of different calls.
Now, Scott, you have a new book about owls, the Peterson Reference Guide to Owls of North America and the Caribbean. What do you love about owls?
I mean, owls are incredibly vocal. And you're right, you know, most owls don't hoot. They make just this ridiculous array of sounds, caterwauling. You know, one of the owls that I studied, the little northern saw-whet owl, sounds like a garbage truck backing up. It's this mechanical tooting sound. Barn owls, which live in old church steeples and barns and silos, sound like demon spawn from the pit of hell. It's this horrible, screeching, banshee wail that will make you believe in ghosts. They're nocturnal. They're mysterious. We know very little about them. They look vaguely human-like. They've got these big round heads and forward-facing eyes. So, I mean, people have been fascinated by owls for as long as we've been human. In fact, if you go back 30,000 years ago on the walls of the Chauvet Cave in France, along with these beautiful murals of cave lions and woolly rhinoceroses, somebody took their finger and inscribed the very clear outline of a little scops owl with its little ear tufts in mud on the wall of the cave. We've loved owls for as long as we've been standing upright as people.
I happen to know that you're pretty good at bird calls. You just mentioned some very interesting owl bird calls. Can you do any of them?
I am terrible at bird calls. This. Actually, and this is a persistent myth that birders go around like imitating bird calls all the time. And the fact of the matter is we have smartphones and iPods like everybody else. If we want to play them, we just, you know, Garrett's recording these amazing things and you can download them in MP3. But, you know, it's funny, barred owls are one of those calls that most birders learn to do. Because it's sort of when they're just calling back and forth, it sounds like they're saying, "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?" And this is kind of weird. But if you're going to make me imitate one, it would be the northern saw-whet owl, because it just sounds like. And it goes on like that for hours. And it's a psychosis-inducing sound. And in the fall, when we're banding them, at this time of the year, we're studying their migration by catching them. By playing that call at 110 decibels so that as they're flying over, they hear it and they fly down and investigate. And we've just, you know, we're spending hours in the woods hearing this thing kind of throbbing in our ears. After a while, you start to hear, you know, you start to hear voices. I mean, it really does weird things to you.
Well, this reminds me, you had a project called Project OwlNet, and it's a collaborative effort among research stations across North America studying owl migration. Mm-hmm. So what you do... What this project does, I should say, is band the owls so you can trace the migratory patterns.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Share with us one incredibly interesting thing you've learned through these tags about owl migration.
Well, just the fact that there's a lot of them. I mean, when we started working with northern saw-whet owls in the mid-1990s, they were chosen as the symbol for Pennsylvania's Wild Resource Conservation Fund because they're so rare. Nobody ever saw them. 3 years ago, in one fall, we caught almost 4,000 of them. I mean, these birds are incredibly common, but they're very secretive, and they're flying at night. And saw-whet owls are found all across North America. They breed across the northern forests and down through the Rockies and the Appalachians. But in the fall, they migrate almost everywhere. So almost wherever anybody is listening to this interview, at night in the fall, there are probably these little owls about the size of a soda can that weigh as much as a robin flying over their house. And we're completely oblivious to it.
You've both studied a lot of raptors, but there's also birds that the raptors feed on as prey. Mm-hmm. In fact, let's hear the song of one of those birds that raptors feed on. And this is the red knot. Garrett, you recorded this bird song. Would you tell us something about what we're about to hear?
Sure. So the red knot is a shorebird species. And for people that aren't familiar with birds, they may be familiar with one shorebird called a sanderling, and that's the little bird that you see chasing waves back and forth on the beach. Well, there's dozens of shorebird species. Many of them nest in the high Arctic and undergo long-distance migrations to South America or southern United States or various southern places. But this particular species, the red knot, nests way high in the Canadian high Arctic and in places in Russia and in Alaska, and they migrate to different places, but the East Coast population from the Canadian Arctic actually goes all the way down to Tierra del Fuego. So these birds undergo these tremendous migrations. And when they're migrating, people always see them in flocks, and they're in winter plumage and kind of dull, and they're quiet. But when they get up on the tundra to nest, they become these very territorial, independent birds, and they get together in pairs. And males of most of these species perform these elaborate display flights accompanied by some of the most beautiful bird vocalizations you'll ever hear. And this bird, the red knot, which I recorded actually in Chukotka in Russia a couple of years back, is doing one of these display flights. And to me, this is one of the most beautiful sounds that I've ever heard in the Arctic, hearing this haunting kind of melancholy call of the red knot over the tundra.
Let's hear it. That's a red knot recorded by our guest, Garrett Vinn. And it sounds, this is so projecting human values onto the bird call. It almost sounds like an alarm.
Yeah, it really does.
Or a siren.
It's funny you say that because alarms and sirens are these repetitive sounds that carry over distance and they keep playing. So eventually you'll hear them, even if it's in a loud, noisy environment. And many of these birds that live in areas where there are no trees do these display flights in the air, and many of them live in very windy environments like the Arctic or the Great Plains grasslands. And so many of them do have these kind of repeated calls. So if you're listening from a far distance, eventually as the wind dies and ebbs and flows, you'll hear that call. So they transmit over a long distance when they repeat them like that over and over.
It's interesting that the song is meant to carry far distances, but in terms of Their feathers are meant to camouflage them. So they're both have these like penetrating sounds, but this camouflaged look to hide.
Yep. When they're in the air and they're calling, they want all the other male red knots in the area to know this is my territory, stay away. And down below, he knows he has a female, most likely, and most likely she's sitting on a nest. And this is actually one of the most difficult shorebirds to find on the ground. They nest in very dispersed. They're not dense nesters, and they are so camouflaged, and they'll sit so tight on the nest that literally you could sit right beside a nest and watch the bird sitting there if you can ever find it.
And are they camouflaging themselves so that the hawks don't find them?
Not for hawks so much in the Arctic as other birds, especially gulls and a few species of jaegers, which are sort of like gulls, but they're predatory birds that feed a lot on the nests of other birds, the nestlings of other birds in the summer up on the tundra. And in the winter, they spend virtually their entire rest of the year at sea, out of sight of land, as far south as the subantarctic. So it's another one of these long-distance migrant birds.
Getting back to that siren-like quality of the red knot, I mean, this is a species that's in serious, serious trouble, not because of Arctic foxes and jaegers and gulls, but because almost all of those red knots come through the Delaware Bay every spring, and they have timed this enormous nonstop migration. So most of them are leaving the coast, the southern coast of Brazil, making a nonstop flight to the mid-Atlantic region in North America, arriving around the middle of May, just timing it so that the horseshoe crabs are coming up out of the deep water of Delaware Bay and crawling up in the beaches and digging their nests and laying tens of thousands of little fat-rich eggs. And the birds need to regain all the weight they've lost flying nonstop from South America, lay on fat that will carry them the rest of the way up into the high Arctic and have enough reserves to carry them through the first weeks of territory establishing and courtship and nest building, because everything's still frozen up there when they arrive. And over the last 15, 20 years, commercial fishermen have taken so many horseshoe crabs out of the Delaware Bay that the horseshoe crab population collapsed, the number of eggs available on the beach collapsed, and we've seen this drastic decline in the number of red knots, which are now listed on the federal threatened species list.
Birds seem like such remarkable animals. I mean, being able to fly is almost the least of it. Mm-hmm. You know, they fly, they sing, they travel thousands of miles and know where they're going, and they get there. They have some kind of internal GPS that mm-hmm. I can't pretend to comprehend. But tell us some of the reasons, each of you, why you are so preoccupied with birds and have devoted, like, your professional lives to birds.
Because birds are really cool. I mean, it's a really banal answer to it, but I've been interested in birds since I was a little kid. So, I mean, I can't tease out the moment when I became entranced by birds. But the more I learn about birds, the more astonishing they become. And you mentioned that they know where they're going. Actually, when they start on their migrations, they don't know where they're going. They've never gone before. Most birds, like these bar-tailed godwits making the flight across the Pacific, they're not flying with mom and dad. They're driven in that direction by an instinct that tells them to fly in a certain direction at a certain time of the year for a certain length of time. They have no idea where they're going. It's not a conscious decision. We've known for the better part of a century that birds have a magnetic sense. Birds may be using a form of quantum entanglement.
I don't even know what that is.
well, it's weird enough that Einstein described it as spooky action at a distance, where if two particles are created at the same moment, they're entangled and function as one thing across potentially millions of light years of space. And this is happening in the eye of a bird in a way that allows them to visualize the Earth's magnetic field. It's this bizarre hypothesis, but there's actually an increasing amount of experimental evidence to back it up. So, you know, the house sparrow that's hopping around your feet at an outdoor cafe picking up crumbs can see and hear and experience aspects of the natural world that we're blind, deaf, and dumb to. They can see bands of polarized light moving across the sky and lockstep with the sun. They can hear extremely low-frequency sound waves that carry halfway around the world. There are some species of seabirds that will smell their way back to their nest burrows among millions of other nest burrows in the blackest of nights just by how that burrow smells.
So there's one bird song that I want to play that is not one that you recorded and brought with you today, Garrett, but it's just so interesting. It's the lyrebird, and this is a bird that has amazing abilities to mimic other sounds. So this is actually an excerpt of a BBC film that David Attenborough recorded, and just tell us a little bit about the lyrebird before we hear this.
Well, lyrebirds are found in Australia, and they're mimics, and there's a lot of birds that are mimics. They pick up either environmental sounds or the sounds of other birds, and the older they are and the more experienced they are and the more sounds they can mimic, it's an indication to a female that I am not just some pimply-nosed teenager that just fell off the boat here, and so I've been around for a long time. And it's kind of an honest indicator of the age and the experience of this male bird, because you can't fake it. But you know, so most people are familiar with northern mockingbirds. That's the famous mimic in this country where they mimic the sounds of other birds. They can, male mockingbird may be able to mimic a couple hundred to a thousand songs of other birds. Now, there are others like brown thrashers that are found in the eastern U.S. that can mimic up to 7,000, but none of them mimic environmental sounds as well as the lyrebird from Australia.
Okay, so this is really remarkable. Let's hear the lyrebird as recorded by David Attenborough for the BBC.
He also, in his attempt to outsing his rivals, incorporates other sounds that he hears in the forest. That was a camera shutter. And now a camera with a motor drive. And that's a car alarm. And now the sounds of foresters and their chainsaws working nearby.
And all those sounds were done by the bird. That wasn't really a chainsaw. That was like the bird imitating a chainsaw. And I thought, this must be like a fraudulent video because it's impossible that a bird could do a chainsaw sound so accurately or the sound of a camera shutter.
But you have to understand, birds have far more vocal agility and flexibility than we do. I mean, for one thing, Birds don't have a larynx like we do. They have an organ called a syrinx, and they can control each side of the syrinx separately. So that allows them to produce two sounds at one time, which gives them more flexibility. And, you know, when you listen to the sound of like a wood thrush or this, you know, these really ethereal bird songs, the harmonics are in there because the bird is actually harmonizing with itself. It's able to sing two notes at the same time. So, I mean, for us, this sounds remarkable. For a bird, this is just a day at the office.
I want to thank you both so much. It's been great. Scott Wiedensahl, Garrett Vinn, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Garrett Vinn shot the photographs in The Living Bird, a new book from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Scott Wiedensahl contributed essays to the book. They spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.